What does a concrete example of privatization look like?
I think the way that they were proposing it is that they want to give more money towards for-profit clinics. So I guess one example in the oncology field is like there are, like I'm not saying they're going to sponsor these because I don't know the list of total healthcare institutions that Doug Ford is planning to sponsor, but there are for-profit infusion clinics that will do therapies that are not recommended by regular oncologists. If a patient couldn't access a certain type of medication because it wasn't government funded, then they could do it at a private infusion clinic because like maybe there are only preliminary studies that show it might have benefit, like a certain drug. But since it's not actually approved by CCO, which is Cancer Care Ontario, then they have to get it done at a private infusion clinic. A worse example of this would be like a different private infusion clinic might do even sketchier therapies like vitamin C infusion therapy, where they give like 50,000 milligrams of vitamin C infusion saying that it'll cure cancer, when obviously that's not the case. I'm not saying that they're going to fund those types of clinics, but you know, it's not like they have any concrete plans in place. So
just to understand then, the idea is that funding, sorry, I need to wrap my head around this. Isn't the whole point of private to not be funded by the government? I swear to God, when we were in school, like the whole notion of private for me is kind of wonky, because isn't the whole point of Canada that you're not allowed to have a two-payer, like you're not allowed to have a two-payer system? Like everything has to be, there is no jumping the line. It has to be publicly funded. Or am I totally misremembering?
I think maybe in theory that's the point, but I think in practice, like, because it's down to the provinces to administer their healthcare, mm-hmm. right? Like no matter what is federally legislated, I think federal legislation is that it's up to the provinces to deliver their form of healthcare. And like, again, going back to the beginning of this topic, we've seen so many budget cuts in our healthcare system that you have, number one, a massive like flock of healthcare workers leaving the healthcare system, leaving it strapped and stripped because of lack of funding. And the answer to that is, like, I'll give you an example. A lot of the nurses that I work with, they're leaving their full-time positions at hospitals to join locum nursing companies because they make more money working locum for hospitals than they do working as full-time staff, right? So they're working for a private company that is tasked with billing a hospital for locum staff because the hospital's not willing to pay their own staff, the hospital's not willing to pay their own staff well, but the hospital's budget doesn't allow for a well-paid position.
I'm getting mad now because that's so dumb. That's so dumb. Because hospitals can't pay their staff a fair wage, staff leaves and then comes back and works for them as a contractor for a higher wage.
Yes.
And this happened a lot.
And that is literally the image of privatization. That is something you could do in-house. You do it so piss poorly that everyone leaves and you have to hire a private company to do it more expensively for you than just doing it at a reasonable
instead
cost.
Instead of training your own staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or training your staff well.
Okay. We solved the problem. It's fucking stupid. I'm over it, bro.
See, this is why we wanted to talk about it, because this is what's happening right now, like on the ground as we speak, and all of like, I don't know if you get the news there, Alexa. I don't know if you get the newspaper in Serbia, but
I have internet.
There's so many times that it keeps coming up in the news that like different emergency departments around the GTA are concerned about their staffing level and are on the brink of closure overnight.
Yes. Yes. I have seen that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's going to get to a point where like, I don't know. I was speaking to someone the other day, and apparently in the Maritimes in Canada, in the Maritime side on the East End, there are some hospitals that are so strapped for resources because they're, number one, they don't pay their healthcare workers very well, much less their physicians. There are some hospitals out there where overnight, all they have on staff in the emergency department is one nurse and a paramedic. That's what they have working in the emerge. And if someone comes in that they cannot triage and handle appropriately, do you know what they have to do? They have to call an ambulance and have them transferred to a further like I guess, urban-centered hospital instead. Or they have to manage them and triage them until the morning when the physician comes.
Rural medicine in a nutshell.
So once again, this makes no sense because I have a question. Where does the money to pay the privates, like the private service providers who yesterday were, let's call it hospital or government staff. Mm-hmm. Where's that money coming from? Like, how does a hospital have a budget for contractors that's greater than their budget for staff members per person? Like, how does that even work? I mean, clearly someone's making a killing. Clearly the nurses are loving it right now. And I would also add, clearly pharmacists are loving it. But the thing is, pharmacy is different. But like, I like the clean cut example of nurses. Like, the finances of that situation literally doesn't add up.
I know.
We're spending more now with more strapped financial resources than we were before when things were more plentiful. Like, how does that even make sense? Where's that money coming from?
I'm gonna go on a whim here and say it's being billed to the government.
And the government just has to pay?
Well, yeah. Because then their case builds that, look, our healthcare system doesn't work and we're ending up spending more money on contract workers because all of our healthcare workers are leaving. So we should just be funding private payers instead.
But they're already doing that at a higher rate than funding their government.
But now they can just write that in instead of it being like an emergency scenario.
But they can't write that in because they're double counting, because it's like our workers are leaving and contractors are coming in. They're the same person.
I know. That's what makes it crazy.
Yeah, it's like the nonsense that they're doing with job reports, like how like job markets are really good, but it's like not just because there's more jobs being filled doesn't mean that there's more people working. No. It's just people taking more jobs. Yes. And like people working two or three jobs. So like the numbers are completely not reflective of reality. This is ridiculous.
Yeah, privatization.
You guys have raised my blood pressure. I'm really angry. I will say this though. There in Serbia, for instance, there is a completely separate private healthcare system. Like, it's not this Willy Wonka nonsense. It's literally hospitals, like fully private hospitals. That will take private insurance and all that other kind of stuff. And then you also have public hospitals.
So it's like the states.
Does the states have public hospitals?
Yeah, states has like public hospitals that are like state funded. They're state funded hospitals. But then they have the nice hospitals that are private.
Yeah, it's basically like that. The public system is not that great. But it's still like serviceable. Like people still go, like things still happen. Yeah. I mean, it'd be interesting now to do like to do a comparison of like wait times with Toronto and like in like Serbia, for instance, or like Canada and Serbia. I don't have that data, but yeah, like it's much more like clear cut in that there's completely private, entirely private. Like, and the thing is that these are like chains of hospitals where like in Belgrade, you have like four or five hospitals under the same franchise banner, right? Much like Shoppers, let's say. And then you'll have a couple or like three or four of these chains all across the main cities in Serbia. And so they will provide service and they're like connected and sort of like fairly well integrated. So that exists and it works pretty well. The fact that the standard of living here isn't that great for some folks doesn't help. But anyway, that's a whole other topic. But like, that seems like a better solution to me than kind of revolving door cycling your own staff. The thing is that the staffing solution is going to be solved by bringing in more people so you can bolster the ranks of the public sector without having to pay through the nose for the privates who yesterday were public. And it's still not clear to me from this whole discussion how funding private healthcare even works, because it's kind of anathema to it being private healthcare.
Well, let's push aside the nursing situation for a second, because I think that is a multifactorial issue. Let's talk about the fact that the best example that we can speak to when it comes to privatization of healthcare is the up-and-coming minor ailments, which removes a bunch of diagnoses. Well, I shouldn't say really removes, but it shifts the responsibility of a bunch of diagnoses to the pharmacy. I don't want to say pharmacist, but to the pharmacy, because they're the ones who are getting the money for it. And instead of patients going to their doctors and having the doctors bill the government for it, now we are just doing it, but at a lesser cost than what the doctor would be billing for. So, I mean, that's one way of doing it. The government is paying the pharmacy to do a service that is rendered in the same way, but for less cost.
So in a way, the funding has increased, but ideally the actual expenditure should decrease. It feels to me like this is also just kind of a like sleight of hand, or like, you know, magic wordplay, where the scope of funding is greater. So there's more funding that is theoretically available, but in increasing access, the overall costs should go down, because the more accessible option will be the cheaper one. So that's going to influence patients' behaviors to seek out the less expensive alternative, in this case, minor illness prescribing.
It's like what happened with flu shots, right? Instead of a patient going to their physician and having, I think it's like $15 for a flu shot, but then they would also bill the visit, which would include whatever their billing amount is. Now a patient just goes to their pharmacy and they get to bill $7.50, though I think that recently increased, but it's still nothing compared to what the doctor was billing.
Fair.
But again, I would state that money goes to whatever corporate entity owns that pharmacy, whether that be independent, corporate, brand, or franchise, not the pharmacist performing the practice, who is the healthcare provider.
That's a really good point to make for us, I think, and for probably the bulk of our audience. But in the scheme, like in the general scheme of like trying to save money, I don't think the government cares. I think that it's just in their interest to try and divert funding and reduce costs overall, if the private entities are the more affordable delivery mechanism, then fair enough. That's interesting. Like it's interesting that pharmacy might seems to be benefiting a lot with these recent sort of changes, whereas the broader healthcare system seems to be struggling.
Well, I think so far from what we said, it sounds like privatization is a great idea, theoretically. But then we know from other examples of like healthcare systems like the NHS that had the two-tiered system where they increased privatization of healthcare, that it doesn't work. So I'm wondering, like, I'm not familiar with all the multitude of changes that have happened in the last decade with the NHS, but I wonder if it reflects what's happening here.
But Chris, let me challenge you for a second. Is the question that it doesn't work, or is the question that it doesn't work for a subset of the population?
That's true.
Because if you've got, like, say, privatization, either whether it be government financing these clinics to operate or patients paying out of pocket, right, with these two-tier systems for access to care in a much more timely way, like we were talking about with those ketamine clinics, it works for those that have money, right? If we're talking about out-of-pocket costs being involved, it works for those who have money, but for those who are not so well fortunate enough, they have to continue accessing public health care. And I think the fear of privatization is that typically government-funded roles are not funded very well, and so those who work in them get paid much less than those who are working in the private sphere. And so all the good doctors, all the good healthcare professionals would slowly float towards the private side of healthcare, which would leave the public side of healthcare weaker, for lack of a better word.
If I may put a political spin on this, as I'm wont to do, typically, if we sort of like blow it up on a higher level and we sort of try and break it down in the entities involved in the interactions, you have the government and then the government funded public executor or delivery mechanism. So in the case of, let's just take the NHS, you had the government that was paying hospitals, and there was a very direct link there. Hospitals were publicly funded entities, and had all the responsibilities that came with that title. Then they were responsible for determining staff. And then you had a government, a UK government at some point, that said, screw janitorial staff. We're going to hire a private company to essentially source janitorial staff for all of our hospitals. And you can replace the staff in this example with anyone else. But the point is basically the government then has a choice to essentially offer up a contract for different providers that then come to the government and essentially lobby them for that service. And it's not going to be the cheapest provider. It's going to be the one who gives the best lobbying or the best kickbacks essentially to the government officials that take that deal. Basically, what I'm saying is that privatization in this particular case introduces the opportunity for a lot of corruption because it's not so tightly linked and the responsibility isn't as obvious. And the thing is that it's been the case where certain government officials who were in charge of these decisions in the UK have been shown to have been benefiting, or like they had stocks in a company that got the contract, stock price pumped, and so on. Like things like that, that basically the more you have fallible human people making decisions and allocating huge sums of money to third parties that are also comprised of fallible people, the risk of corruption increases versus having a public system that is much more tightly linked, much more tightly controlled, has a direct responsibility towards the taxpayer, and not a private company that's being funded by the government, which quote unquote has responsibility to the taxpayer. The flip side of this is that one could argue that the NHS was built kind of from the ashes of World War II in the UK, and that like in the 50s and 60s, with a lot of money coming in from the States, because the British and the Americans have a really, really good relationship, and America was unscathed by the war and emerged as a superpower, and was also funding the Brits through tons of credits for like rebuilding after the war. One could argue that the NHS in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even 90s was really strong because it had a lot of sort of credit and American sort of capital backing it up and, you know, allowing it to be this huge, awesome beacon of standard of care globally. But as times change, mismanagement happens and so on, it started going in the red. Now, the question is, did it go in the red because it simply was doomed to fail because of the nature of its inception? Or was it going in the red because it started running really, really poorly and bad managerial decisions were being made? I don't know. We can definitely link some articles in the show notes if someone's interested reading more about this. Because the NHS is a really interesting example where it was like literally the best example of a fully, I'm going to use integrated very loosely, but fully integrated public healthcare system that's now collapsing. And it's one of the big things that the British public is terrified of, because it was such a cornerstone of like the British identity. And now it just seems like it's going down the toilet.
You don't have to answer this question if you don't know it, but I know that a lot of physicians in the NHS and pharmacists too are really poorly paid compared to Western countries. Has that always been a feature of the NHS? Because I feel like, you know, if you just paid everyone less, then you could certainly have more people as long as they're willing to be paid less, you know? Like you could fund a lot more services if you just paid everyone less.
That is a good point. That's possible that's the case. And if you look at the example we're having now with Canada, it's like if we're paying contract nurses more, we can have fewer of them. So the problem exacerbates itself. I do know from limited experience that UK pharmacists love it in Canada, both from the quality of patient time that they can spend. So it's they're like in the NHS, it seems like every store is just like conveyor belt. Whereas in Canada, it seems like they can actually have like a solid time. Again, depending on the store, but like this was the experience of a UK pharmacist in a small mom and pop shop that really enjoyed their time because they could actually like develop patient relationships, deliver quality care, and that kind of stuff. So I don't know how it was before and if the pay grade steadily declined, but I think it's reasonable to assume that it just hasn't kept pace with inflation and cost of living increases that have taken place over the last 20 years. So, incomplete answer, I suppose.
I don't know. What do you think, Chris? Like, I mean, you're a public servant now, right?
I guess so.
What's your take on you were talking about private oncology clinics, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think my main concern I have with private clinics is I'm worried that they would complete procedures that are like not standard of care, but then go with what the patient wants. And like, I'm not sure what the funding model still looks like under Doug Ford. Like, I think the idea is that that wouldn't happen. So maybe that's like an unfounded concern of mine. Because like, if you're only supposed to fund like government covered procedures, but they're just done in a private infusion clinic, then there's no problem. But then later on, I think the knock-on effects is what you said earlier, Faison, which is if there's more money in private healthcare, then maybe you'll see a shift of the workforce towards private healthcare, and then those who are in public healthcare kind of get left behind.
Well, let's even take example of that. There's an article that was shared in one of our group chats, Chris, about this lady who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. I think it's like a late stage appendix cancer.
Pancreatic, yeah.
Right. What is it, pancreatic?
I don't know.
Okay.
I didn't even read the article.
Basically, let me get you familiar on this one, Alexa. So essentially, it's a lady. She's followed by, the article said Canadian doctors. So she essentially is diagnosed with terminal cancer at this point. So she's received treatment, has not worked well. The cancer has metastasized throughout her body, and she has been deemed as her cancer's inoperable. Okay. And she's been considered as, she's now a palliative patient. Okay. She wasn't unfortunately willing to, I mean, it's a very sad story that this lady is now palliative, but she has decided to go to the States to receive treatment in the form of surgery. So her cancer is deemed inoperable in terms of her tumors being removed. But there is a physician in the States who claims that he has expertise in this form of cancer and will be able to remove her cancer, at least try to remove the cancer that has metastasized throughout her body, for the great sum of $100,000. And this is his words. He said that usually in his experience, the number of tumors are between anywhere from hundreds to thousands. And if the tumor is attached to an organ and that tumor cannot be removed, if the organ is not needed or not necessary, then they'll remove that organ as well. And so we were kind of talking about the fact that, you know, you have our public healthcare system that, I mean, it works and has treated this lady to the best of our ability. And it's not like they're trying to pass off the cost or anything like that by saying we can't do anything more for you. I mean, clinically, it seems like this lady is at this point palliative, right? But she's deciding to spend $100,000 to go to the United States in order to receive this treatment, which has no guarantee for success. And the way that it's described, honestly, like, I'm not even sure what her quality of life would be after a successful surgery, given that they have to do that many resections of tumors and possibly have organs removed. But this doctor is willing to do it for a small fee of $100,000.
I'm not concerned about that type of thing happening in Canada. I don't think it'll ever get to that point. And I say that now. Maybe I'll bite my words in the future when we're doing these crazy surgeries. But like,
well, I could say the nurses probably never expected their raises to be capped at 1% per year.
That's true. Or right? Wage freezes forever.
I don't know, Alexa. What's your take on this? Alexa, he's just upset now.
He's so tilted.
He's so tilted.
Alexa's still reeling from the beginning of this conversation.
That is my favorite. No, I mean, like, dude, it's... Christ. It's the, like... Here's the problem. I genuinely do believe I like this is again, I'll stick more to an ideological point because that's kind of the lens I try to analyze everything through. But basically, if someone wants to buy a service, they should be allowed to buy that service or product. It is up to the patient, it is up to the consumer to be informed enough to make that choice, though. Like, that's why the concept of informed consent is so important. That's why it's important to have transparency of information. That's why, like, that's why more than anything, information is important. And by that, I also mean discussion around a piece of information, the safety of a procedure, the validity of a therapy. Like, Chris, for instance, the vitamin C thing, I actually know, I don't personally know, but I know second or third hand people who have actually tried the vitamin C thing and have like been cured. So it's like, I have no idea. You know what I mean? Like, is that just like the strongest placebo effect we've ever seen? Maybe. Beats me. Is it completely not that? And maybe some weird nutritional thing that they did as a sort of side effect of vitamin C that actually has untapped anti-cancer effects? Who knows? But the whole point that I'm trying to make is that I think that information should be discussed. Nothing should be blatantly discounted unless it's like an obvious cash grab where it's like, okay, you're just a snake oil salesman. And the thing is, even I use that term sort of cautiously, because back in the day in the Wild West, where like people were literally, you know, in a caravan going town to town and scamming people out of the money and then making a getaway in the middle of the night, like, you didn't have access to information. You didn't have people sharing data. You didn't have good data collection. So like all that kind of stuff. And by data collection, I mean also like anecdotal things with like trackable outcomes. So in that case, I do think that the discussion around given therapies and stuff like that is important. So with this dude in the States, the first thing that came to mind is I would love to see his case records. So it's like he has experience in that. I would love to see his previous cases. I'd like to see testimonies from his previous patients and their family members and so on to get a clear idea, if I was a consumer of his services, to know what he's doing and to basically see the outcome of his stuff. I'd also probably get a second opinion where physicians, like most physicians, might be like, that's insane. Dismiss him out of hand, but I'd still want a seriously critical clinical eye looking at that and to give me a thought on those cases, because those might be doctored cases. You know what I mean? You never know, right? So the idea is that that's why regulatory boards exist, and they should do that sort of quote unquote fact checking for the consumer. The problem is that either companies will always find ways to, you know, find ways around it. The classic example, like Volkswagen doctoring or like specifically having their engines have fewer CO2 emissions on test conditions rather than in real life. Or in the case of like corruption, where like officials from government officials are explicitly bribed for certain patents and authorizations and stuff like that. So ultimately, this is a long-winded answer, I know, and I apologize, but ultimately, I think we should be allowed to buy and provide whatever services we deem of like reasonable. And it is up to the market and the consumer to determine what is and isn't reasonable. And if the price point is $100,000 and this lady is sure that she wants it, no one should really stop her. But the thing is that there also has to be a broader culture of informed consumer that isn't just, oh, the government will make sure that this is safe for me, or like, oh, it's the manufacturer's duty to make sure it's safe for me. Like, how many times do people get swindled by their car mechanics? It's like mechanics, and that's where you get into the problem of information asymmetry, which is the problem I haven't resolved in my own mind and like my own life. It's like, how do you have a good faith conversation with someone who has the financial incentives to screw you over on the fact that they know more than you? And how are you supposed to be up to date on all the services you need? Because if you know as much as a mechanic, you might as well do the job yourself. But in principle, things should be allowed and people should just be informed with those decisions they make.
I guess the worst part is, in the case of privatization of healthcare, it's like you're talking about taxpayers' money. It's like we don't even get a choice, you know? It's like we have to pay taxes, and then the government is choosing where to put that money for us. So it's like we don't even get to have this conversation of, oh, are they informed or not, or like whatever. It's like, oh, we're just giving this money to private clinics.
100%. Like, well, that being said, I mean, and I don't know if we've had this discussion or if I've brought it up, or it might seem trite, but in my mind, I guess I haven't analyzed this this example enough, but maybe you guys are going to poke holes in it. But basically, let's take the point. Let's take the point of like religious expression, right? So if someone is like against contraception for religious reasons, they pay taxes that cover contraceptives, right? It's like, so a fraction of their yearly taxes goes towards contraception. That's like against their religion, right? So are they forced to support an intervention that they disagree with on a sort of religious and personal level? One could make the case that they are. I'm not going to go into like a libertarian tirade on how taxes are theft, but Chris, you raise a good point, how with the notion of taxes and like public dollars, you hope that the government is making the right choice and responsible choice on what to spend on. The problem is, which I've raised earlier, which is that when the government has a huge pot of gold, they can choose who gets that money and then also how that money gets redirected back to them. And not the government, but to private pockets in the government. That is to say, people's private bank accounts. And that's the part that's really sketchy. But that's always been the case. So it's, you know, how does the government give a contract to any third party? It's probably on relationship as much as it is on value, like value add and service provided, but that's just inevitable. Like when with the concept of taxes, that kind of comes with the territory.
I'm sure there was no RFP in their decision making when they vendor out these contracts.
What's RFP?
What do you mean?
A request for proposal. It's like a formal
No, of course there are.
No, of course there are. I don't think so, Alex. I think in some of these cases it's more like, hey, like we had a good dinner the other night.
You're being more tinfoil hat than me? Wow, Faizan, you've come such a long way.
I'm just saying, there's a reason why certain politicians receive their flu shots at only certain pharmacies.
I know that we have a trend in the West to rationalize everything into like, you know, if I can't see it plain as day, you know, if I can't see A to Z, then it's not real, or it's, you know, it's noise instead of signal. But there's things like that, that comment, which I really appreciate, which are these kind of small tidbits that we pick up on. And by we, I mean literally our senses. Like we rationally, you brought it up, but it's like things that, you know, the gut feeling, which is essentially just sort of a synthesis of all your like sensory inputs being distilled into a sense and not even a rational thought. And I think that's important when making these discussions. I'm not saying, and when having these discussions, I'm not saying that everyone should just like act on impulse, far from it. But there has to be a healthy balance of like rationalization, because the issue with rationality is that it can get hijacked by incorrect basic assumptions or incorrect information. And then you can reach a conclusion that's actually wrong. Whereas your gut is a lot more primal. And it can still sense when something's off. Even that piece of information which you rely on, which may be false, which your rationality is relying on, your gut may be like, something's up with that thing, but it doesn't know what it is. It might be the way that the information was delivered to you. So it's not even the information itself which is tipping you off that it's wrong. It's the delivery from the person that told you it, or whatever, you know, other sort of other sensory inputs might have been at the time. So I'm just saying it's important to follow one's kind of gut when making these kinds of questions and having these discussions. Because I feel like it's easy to over-rationalize. And I mean, God knows there's tons of papers and tons of economic articles written in both directions. But again, we don't know where the money for that funding is coming from. Like the funding for that research and those papers is coming from. So even that's really sus.
All this to say that we have no idea what is going on with privatization of healthcare.
I do think that we do have something to say to our listeners, which is to be skeptical and to think about this and to not necessarily think about binary answers. It's like, oh, are you for or against privatization? Like if anyone now Thanksgiving's passed, but if anyone at the dinner table asks you, try to be nuanced in your response. Try to say, well, it depends what privatization entails. Like, is it this or that? And just like we've talked about in the episode, like binary answers generally, I think, are a trap and are something that I think we in the West have maybe been conditioned to operate within, but I think it's a false premise.
And I think it's like, that's like the way that it's sold too, right? Like when Doug Ford says, oh, we're going to privatize healthcare, it's going to lead to improved access. Like there's it's not that simple, you know? If only it was that simple, we would have done this so much earlier, right? It's so easy. We break it down a little bit further, but even beyond just the fact of like, where is the money going? In the end, In the end, I like your example where you're like, oh, someone who doesn't believe in contraceptive is technically still paying for it. That just makes me think, now my whole argument is moot because I've been making people pay for medication that I believe in all this whole time. Now I'm being a hypocrite. So just because they're doing things that I don't like, I'm suddenly up in arms.
Well, I think it's interesting because on the point of me being tinfoil hat, Alexa, I think I'm becoming more and more cynical as I got older because I feel like the general population thinks that corruption is solved when countries move to like a first world state. But I think corruption, I think the general population, and I'm sounding like I'm on InfoWars, but I think corruption, I believe that corruption is just as rampant as it is in any other country. When we're talking about the West, it's just more smoke and mirrors. It's just the fact that it's not like you bribing a police officer. It's more that elected officials are being bribed behind the scenes. And it's not just like the passing of a huge wad of cash. Again, it's just more smoke and mirrors. It's more like you scratch my back, I scratch your back, but I'll scratch it later in the future. Don't you worry, kind of thing, right? So it's not as obvious. It's not so out in the forefront. And we're all taught as the rest of the population that this isn't the case, that, you know, everyone has the best interests of you in mind, right? But I think anytime, no matter who the government is that is in control, whenever some sort of new initiative is being brought out, just like Chris said, right? Like privatization of healthcare is being doted as the savior of the failures of our healthcare system. But really what we should always be asking ourselves is, who is it truly benefiting in the end? Like, is it really a patient-focused initiative? Because we can solve patient-focused initiatives and the lack of our healthcare system by just funding it more, right? Why do we need this extravagant solution that's out of the box when we already had one that worked for so many years? So I think considering those things is also important to keep in mind as a regular citizen of this country. Tinfoil hat off.
Similar to, like, or like adding on to why we have to come up with these convoluted solutions, I think it's because we kind of have these basic assumptions, like Alexa was saying, that are incorrect. Like, one basic assumption you might think is that we have limited resources for healthcare. Whereas, yes, we obviously do have limited resources, but we could reallocate money from one pot to another, right? Because you have a government budget, you could technically move money around.
Which is always done.
Yeah, which is always done. So if the general population is told that there's not enough money in healthcare and we have to allocate funds to private healthcare somehow, and that's the only solution, then that's like a basic assumption that is incorrect. And then then people are led to believe that that is the only solution, right?
I would also just add that it seems like a lot of public sectors are generally being stripped of their funding. Like, I mean, Toronto is a great example. The infrastructure in Toronto is dog shit. The Gardiner is undergoing like repairs, or has been for years, but it's still in terrible condition. I don't know what the sort of projections are for the Gardiner's lifespan, but like, it's not looking good. There's potholes on streets that haven't been fixed for decades. Like, there's two seasons in Toronto. There's winter and construction season. Like, I remember, like, regardless, but I'm just saying, so like, and that's one sense, which is like infrastructure, like roads, right? And waterways. So like the basics of a functioning city are not being tended to. Healthcare is suffering. Education is suffering. Not enough teachers and so on. Like huge classrooms. Now currently also being run on Zoom, which is a huge question. Well, not now, but during the pandemic. So it seems to me like a lot of taxes or a lot of money that from was going from taxes to these things is being siphoned to other places. Now, we don't see what these other places are, but it does seem like the public's interest is not being served with the sort of current tax allocation, budget, whatever. And then more troubling is also the fact that like average everyday citizens are paying more in taxes than millionaires and like massive corporations because of a bunch of tax loopholes and so on and so forth, yada, yada, which has been covered extensively in the news. Like literally just type in Jeff Bezos didn't pay taxes 2019, I think. Just that's one example. But basically the argument that taxes like that's what, and I don't want anyone listening to this who's like a hardcore libertarian who thinks taxes shouldn't be a thing at all to think that I'm advocating for like increased tax rates, because that doesn't do anything because the loopholes still exist. So any party that's like, oh, we're going to tax the rich more, it's like that's not going to do anything until you plug the loopholes, which won't happen because the very politicians in power are the ones who exploit those tax loopholes. Not rocket science. So
no,
I
love this because like this discussion has been fantastic because we've gone from like describing the privatization of healthcare, and then like I feel like with the whole podcast we've just like gone way more philosophical into these ideas than we used to before. Thanks, Alexa. But like unironically, thank you. And it's just amazing that like everything in healthcare is just like so frustrating, because I feel like the actual solutions are so easy. Like if we were in power and had infinite resources, obviously the solutions are easy. You just put more money in, right? You just get more people. But then I don't know, like what can we even take away from the fact that Ontario is turning towards more privatization of healthcare? Like, is pharmacy fucked? Like, what can you do as a pharmacist? Like, what is like at the end of the day, like, what do people even get out of this podcast from listening?
I don't know. I would love to hear from our listeners. Like, why do they tune in to just hear the ramblings of Anne or three lunatics? But I do want to say one thing though, because I think another one of those things, which is like the premise of a discussion, is like, what is the problem that healthcare solves? A sick population. That might be false. The problem that healthcare solves is how do you put money in pockets through the treatment of sick people? So the therapy of sick people is a secondary outcome, but the lining of pockets is actually the primary outcome. And if that's the case, healthcare is working lovely, right? It's working wonderfully for the people in power. And I think that's one of the really big moments that I've had recently, which is like when you look at any system, any kind of tool or structure that's designed, it's serving a function for the daily end user, us, the citizenry. But there's a lot more happening behind the scenes and a lot more money being shifted around in the back end. And I don't want to say it's money laundering, but it's kind of money laundering, where you have the money from, you know, citizens' pockets being put into the government, and then that government reallocates it to other more well-connected private pockets. That's all it really is. So that's all I'll say, is that consider the true purpose of any given intervention or system or structure, and maybe it's actually doing exactly what it's intended to do. Right. Like as another example is like TV. Is TV meant to, or like the news? Is the news meant to keep the citizenry informed, or is it meant to push ideologies? Because if it's trying to keep the citizens informed, it's doing a pretty bad job. But if it's trying to push ideologies, it's doing a great job. And you can take the TV or you can take like the internet and like social media. Is social media about connecting people, or is it about making people more and more dissociated from each other, more and more estranged, you know, driving up mental health issues, which in and of themselves are super profitable in other ways, because then people are more susceptible to influence from external sources and so on. Like, what's the actual purpose of a thing should be thoroughly questioned before someone comes to the conclusion if it's quote unquote working well or not.
Off the Script is produced by Chris Tse, Faizan Beg, Alexa Stanchik, and Tom Fung. Quality control is completed by Stephen Guan. Mixing and editing is done by Chris Tse. Off the Script is a podcast focused on education and entertainment. We are not a replacement for real medical advice. Please see your local healthcare professional for your health needs. Thank you to Sean Singh for creating our introductory music. And thank you to Chillhop for letting us use their music for our intermission and ending. You can find more of their music at chillhop.com/listen.